Good day, this is Greg, and I'll be reading the Vermilion County News for Tuesday, October 15th, 2019. And we will start with the front page of the commercial news. Our first story is entitled Casino Items on Tonight's City Agenda. And this is by Jennifer Bailey. Danville. Three more steps in the casino process will occur at tonight's Danville City Council meeting. The first on the agenda is a public hearing for certification of casino development and casino applicant. This is a city requirement under Senate Bill 690 for the casino license application. The City Council also must approve a resolution stating the city approves the details of the proposed casino. The resolution memorializing agreements regarding the casino and casino applicant states Haven Gaming LLC has negotiated in good faith with the corporate authority of the City of Danville. Haven Gaming LLC and the city have mutually agreed on the temporary and permanent location of the casino being property at the I-74 Lynch Road interchange. The proposed development is reflected in the conceptual drawings and other documents. It further states Haven Gaming LLC and the city have mutually agreed on the percentage of revenues that will be shared with the city, as well as other benefits for the city and local entities contained in a host community agreement. Haven Gaming of Wonder Lake and the city have mutually agreed upon creating a planned development zoning overlay to address any potential zoning issues regarding the casino development on the property. No public health, licensing, or other issues have been identified that may impact the casino development. If any licensing or other issues arise, Mayor Ricky Williams Jr. and legal counsel are authorized to work with Haven Gaming to reach mutual agreement as to those issues. In a letter from Haven Gaming's attorney, Scott Seipold, he states to Williams, "We thank you for the honor of partnering with Danville and the creation of a world-class casino resort destination. This letter will outline our acceptance and guarantee of your HCA, or Host Community Agreement, term sheet. Our understanding and acceptance of these terms is as follows. Economic terms. One-time upfront payments, $1 million for improvements to the riverfront, $1 million for an expansion of the Boys and Girls Club of Danville, and $1 million for municipal improvements. Each of these are to be planned with the mayor, in addition to the club director for the club expansion and economic development manager for the riverfront and municipal building improvements, and paid after written issuance of the casino license by the Illinois Gaming Board. Also, fixed annual payments, $100,000 in United Way contributions, $50,000 each to Vermilion Advantage, Fisher Theater, scholarships to Danville Area Community College and Public Safety, and other municipal service payments. They will be planned and paid annually at mutually agreed times. Variable annual payments shall consist of 4% of earnings before interest, depreciation, and amortization, minus any and all taxes and government fees. Failure to open by mutually agreed date or the date prescribed by the Illinois Gaming Board is $20,000 a day. Failure to continuously operate, $20,000 a day. Both are subject to force majeure, unforeseeable circumstances that prevent the fulfilling of the contract. The operator agrees to forego the local portion of enterprise zone benefits. Under employment, the operator will use commercially reasonable efforts to create no fewer than 400 construction jobs at the project, participation targets of 10% work-qualified minorities, 5% work-qualified women, and 5% work-qualified veterans. At opening, the operator will use commercially reasonable efforts to employ no fewer than 600 persons, no fewer than 400 persons to be full-time equivalents. After opening, the operator will use commercially reasonable efforts to achieve labor participation of 75% of work-qualified Vermilion County residents. Labor participation also is to see no less than 30% minority persons, 40% women, and 5% veterans. Under business utilization, at least 50% of annual biddable goods and services will be prioritized for local procurement from Vermilion County if commercially reasonable. Operator will use commercially reasonable efforts to award contracts for the design and construction of the project, utilizing 15% minority business, 15% women business, and 5% veteran business enterprise businesses. Operator will use commercially reasonable efforts to purchase goods and services for the project from at least 10% MBE, 10% WBE, and 5% VBE. Infrastructure improvements. Operator will fully implement and fund all traffic improvements and other infrastructure improvements deemed necessary by engineer Will Matzik of Kimley Horn, specific to the proposed casino site. And under miscellaneous, operator's obligation will be guaranteed by a creditworthy parent company or affiliate. Operator agrees to notify and consult the mayor of Danville before any ownership transfer of a 5% interest or more, and shall fully comply with all rules, regulations, and laws of the Illinois Gaming Board. Operator shall use commercially reasonable efforts to negotiate a project labor agreement with the East Central Illinois Building and Construction Trades Council relating to construction on the project. Subject to applicable securities laws and after formal written proof of vetting and approval by the Illinois Gaming Board, operator will use commercially reasonable efforts to interview and consider Vermilion County residents as possible investors in the project. Also at tonight's meeting, the City Council will consider approving an ordinance amending the zoning ordinance and map to approve the planned unit development for Danville Casino Acquisition, LLC. Our next story from the Commercial News is entitled, Eminent Domain Could Be Used for Carl Project. This is also by Jennifer Bailey. Danville. Alan Dixon says he wants a reasonable price for a vacant lot and a lot with his business, a commercial garage. City officials have been negotiating with Dixon for the property to be used in the proposed Carl Medical Campus project off Logan Avenue. Dixon owns the lots at 201 North Logan Avenue and 606 West Madison Street, and says the city is lowballing on its offers. It's sad, Dixon said. Dixon also was involved with the city in an eminent domain case a couple of years ago for the roundabout at Jackson and English Streets. The city was awarded a vacant lot Dixon owned on Jackson Street for $1,400. The appraisal was $1,200, city officials said. City officials said lawsuits would be filed after the property owners didn't accept offers and negotiations ceased. At tonight's Danville City Council meeting, aldermen will consider authorizing eminent domain to acquire fee simple title to and possession of certain real estate for the Carl Project. In addition to Dixon's properties, the city also seeks these properties after owners have not accepted offers. 123 North Logan Avenue, owned by Chris Carpenter. 505 Lafayette Street, owned by Charles Hagen. And 118 North Logan Avenue, owned by Tamara Lopez. The eminent domain complaints seeking judicial order granting property rights by condemnation go through Vermilion County Circuit Court. According to the resolution, the city has the power to acquire property through condemnation where necessary for the rehabilitation or redevelopment of a blighted area that contains buildings that are dilapidated or contains deleterious uses that are a detriment to the public health and safety. Carle plans to consolidate its North Vermilion and Fairchild Streets facilities and ambulance service on Franklin Street into a $50 million Carle Danville Medical Campus west of the downtown area from Logan Avenue on the west that will close part of Logan just north of North Street for the campus to span both sides of Logan, Robinson Street to the east, North Street to the south, and Madison Street to the north. Last month, resident Vince Kerrs said he was concerned about the city allowing Logan Avenue to be closed for the new Carle Medical Campus project. He said the original idea had two parallel buildings on Logan connected by a walkway over Logan Avenue. The proposal, now closing the street, would relocate the main pathway for ambulances and citizens to the hospital, Kerrs said. Kerrs said it sounded like local administrators were anxious to please Carle, but added, no one has approved anything. He said he doesn't like the city doing business privately and secretively. The closure of part of Logan Avenue would have major repercussions for the city, Kerrs said. He said relocating utilities likely will be costly, and the view overlooking Ellsworth Park will be lost to the public and citizens and given to the building and patients. He said the decisions should be made openly. Other city council agenda items included the following: paying for storm damage or storm drainage improvements, rezoning 826 East Main Street for a digital sign at Trinity Lutheran Evangelical Lutheran Church, in addition to rezoning adjacent property owned by the church from R2 single-family residential zoning to B2 highway business zoning at 818, 828, and 830 East Main Street. Approving railroad crossing improvements on Griffin Street. Approving additional funding for the roundabout. Authorizing Baird Public Finance to serve as managing underwriter in issuance of Series 2019 bonds and the refunding of Series 2009 general obligation bonds. Tax levy and budget study session, and authorizing the purchase of real property after closed session. In our final story from the front page of the commercial news is entitled Sweet Dreams, Pillow Project Teaches Sewing Skills. And this is by Carol Rome. Danville. With social media and video games preoccupying most middle schoolers these days, it's a little unusual that eighth graders at North Ridge Middle School are clamoring for a chance to sew the old-fashioned way with needle and thread. Librarian Kimberly Blodgett started the Pillow Project last year as a way to keep children who were excused from physical education busy while they were in her care in the library. After the children grew bored of playing Scrabble and games on the library's computers, Blodgett decided to share a hobby of hers, sewing. Word spread around the school about the Pillow Project going on at the library, and Blodgett found herself fielding requests from both boys and girls alike to take up sewing during their lunch period. They're calm while they are working on their pillow, and they help each other out. And I like it here because they're not in a noisy cafeteria, she said. When the bell rings, no one wants to stop. By the end of the last school year, 72 seventh and eighth graders had designed and sewn their own pillows, she said. I was buying fabric on my own until Superintendent Dr. Gaddis told me that there was money available for that, she said. Blodgett applied for and received a $500 grant from the Danville Public School Foundation that helped defray the cost of the materials and allowed her to expand the Pillow Project to all 300-plus 8th graders this year. It's not only a girl thing, she said. I just had four boys sign up for the next session. It takes about a week to create a pillow, and Blodgett can accommodate 10 children at a time for a sewing session. They pick out the fabric. They have to take a ruler and measure it and cut it, she said. They design their pillow and sew it, and they have to at least sew a button on it. Not only is the pillow project a math lesson in disguise, but the children hone their fine motor skills and gain a life skill of learning how to sew. Three boys were making camo pillows last year, and their stitches were getting too big. So we had a contest to see who could make the smallest stitches, Blodgett said, of encouraging the children to sew neatly. Blodgett also allows the students to be as creative as they like when embellishing their pillow. Most of them use fabric paint to write their initials or name, or they decorate their pillow some other way. One girl broke open colorful markers and created a tie-dyed effect on the fabric of her Sugar Skull pillow. Five kids so far this year have made pillows for their moms, she said. This year, Blodgett is encouraging the children to add a small note while stuffing their pillow. They could write what their dream is for their future, or something they love about their mom, on a little sticky note in the stuffing, she said. Eighth grader Krista Hurst was finishing a pillow with treble signs and music notes all over it. Krista said she selected that particular fabric because she is a cello player. As she sewed one end of the pillow closed, she said, "My mom taught me how to sew one time, but I didn't get it. I'm debating whether to give this to my mom or my teacher," Krista said of her creation. "My mom loves pillows, my teacher loves music, and I love both." Krista's classmates were impressed when the pocket on Krista's hoodie ripped and she sewed it back on. She was walking around sewing on the hoodie, eighth grader Olivia Roberts said. Ethan Fox planned to give his purple heart-shaped pillow to his mom. "My great-grandma taught me how to sew when I was 8 or 9, he said. "She made everyone in my family a quilt for Christmas. I still sleep with her quilt every night." Carissa Torres said the Mickey Mouse-themed pillow she made would be the perfect birthday gift for her sister. "I'm going to give it to my sister," she said. "Her birthday was October 3rd, and I didn't get her anything yet." Natori Williams said her favorite part of the project was decorating and sewing her pillow. "I liked adding the polka dots," she said. Aliyah Hilsman said, "I liked picking out my fabric. It goes with the theme of my room." Saraya Chestnut was just beginning to sew her pillow, but she already knew how she wanted to decorate it. "I'm going to put my name on it and paint it," she said. Some kids who made pillows last year tell me they still have it on their bed, Blodgett said. "This project has been really gratifying." And now we'll turn to the obituaries for Tuesday, October 15th, 2019. And the first is for Leon Clarence Snyder. Leon Clarence Snyder, 74, of Hillsboro, Indiana, passed away at his residence Friday morning, October 11th, 2019, with his family at his side. Funeral service will be at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time on Thursday, October 17th, at Dickerson Funeral Home in Vetersburg, Indiana, with Dr. Homer Fawcett officiating. Visitation will begin at noon Eastern Daylight Time Thursday at the funeral home and continue until the time of service at 2 p.m. Burial will be at Waynetown Masonic Cemetery. Dallas Ponder. Dallas J. Ponder, 80, of rural Vetersburg, Indiana, passed away at 6:54 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Sunday, October 13th, 2019, at Community Heart and Vascular Hospital in Indianapolis, Indiana. A funeral service will be at 2 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, Friday, October 18th, at Dickerson Funeral Home in Vetersburg, with Pastor Gary Johnson officiating. Visitation will begin at noon on Friday and continue until the time of service. Burial will be at Rockfield Cemetery near Vetersburg. In lieu of flowers, the family would prefer memorial contributions be given to Sterling Christian Church, Indiana Junior Charolais Association, or Indiana Junior Beef Cattle Association. John Norman Spinning. John Norman, or Jack Spinning, 85, passed away peacefully October 8, 2019. A visitation will be from 6 to 8 p.m. on Thursday, October 17th, at Hartage Giddens Oaklawn Chapel at 4801 San Jose Boulevard, Jacksonville, Florida. A private funeral service will be at Hartage Giddens Oaklawn Chapel with interment following the service in Oaklawn Cemetery. James Capilano. James Donald Capilano, 56, passed away October 10, 2019. A celebration of life for James will be at 11:30 a.m. until 4:30 p.m. on Saturday, October 26th, at Middle Fork Forest Preserve. Dinner will be served, interment at Glen Cemetery in Paxton, Illinois. Memorial suggested to a charity of your choice. And that's all of the obituaries for today. We have a little extra time, so we're going to read a column from the opinion page. And this is actually from the Southern Illinoisan Carbondale Sunday. And it's entitled, for the column is Midwest Voices, and it's entitled, Blame Teachers? Board? Nope, it's the state's funding system. The strike that kept Murfreesboro School District 186 students out of classrooms for 5 days isn't the result of a get-rich-quick scheme by teachers, and it isn't the result of a miserly school board hoarding pennies. It is just another symptom of the inadequate, unfair, and archaic way Illinois funds schools. Property taxes continue to make up the bulk of school funding in Illinois. Schools receive some money from the state, some from federal programs, but in most instances, 2/3 of the money comes from local property taxes. That was probably workable 100 or 150 years ago. It's not a stretch to think of people in rural areas of the state banding together to build a one-room building equipped with a chalkboard and pot-bellied stove with an outhouse in the yard. Parents just had to pay a single teacher, most of whom worked for modest salaries and basic textbooks for the rudimentary education the children received. But today, that's not the way it works. In many southern Illinois counties, there is just a single school district. Schools have to be large enough to house hundreds of students. Paying for schools means operating a fleet of buses, buying equipment for chemistry labs and computers, and paying the salaries of dozens of teachers. The math of supporting schools has gotten a lot more complicated. And that math tells us several disturbing things. In most instances, the quality of education students receive is based on zip code. Information released by the Illinois State Board of Education this summer verifies the obvious. Students in wealthier districts score higher in basic math and language skills. Perhaps even more disturbing, taxpayers in property-rich districts pay much lower tax rates than poorer areas of the state. ISBE statistics show tax rates in the state vary from 1.3% in rich districts to 21% in poorer areas. It's inequitable, it's unfair, and it has to be changed. Illinois' continued reliance on property tax funding for schools is largely responsible for school strikes like we saw in Murfreesboro, or like we almost saw in Carbondale. Teachers' strikes are generally an incredibly divisive experience in small towns. But how do you pick sides in a teacher's strike? Teaching is a noble profession. We need to pay our teachers a living wage to make the profession attractive to the best and brightest who feel the calling to step into the classroom. Conversely, school districts have finite resources at their disposal. School boards have to figure out how to maintain buildings, purchase supplies, keep the buses running, and provide adequate compensation for their teachers. If the numbers don't add up, it's not as if a school board can go out and raise more money. Anyone who has lived in Southern Illinois for more than a decade or two knows how difficult it is to pass a bond issue raising taxes. As a result, school boards have gotten more creative. Most Southern Illinois counties have implemented sales taxes that are dedicated to schools. But the money must be used for capital improvements. Looking at the number of new schools in Southern Illinois, it's obvious the sales taxes have been helpful, but it's equally obvious they aren't the answer. The recently implemented evidence-based funding shows promise, but it is a long-range program that will not adequately solve immediate problems. Illinois, cash-strapped as it is, must find a way to pour more money into education coffers or install a new funding mechanism. Currently, there are two new revenue streams that could be tapped. Taxes from expanded gambling could be dedicated to education. That seemed like a good idea when the Illinois Lottery was instituted, but legislators simply lowered the education appropriations. That cannot happen again. The legalization of marijuana will bring new revenue to the state. A portion of that money could be funneled toward education. Will that funding solve the problem? No, not totally. But every dollar helps, and if the additional funds can prevent future labor shutdowns, we're all winners. And next we have this letter from Dear Annie. Dear Annie, my neighbor has a huge tree growing squarely in the middle of her yard. The tree is so big that a limb crashed down and broke part of a fence I share with another neighbor. I was left with the repair and the cleanup. When I mentioned this situation and my safety concern to the neighbor with the tree, she responded, "Whatever falls onto your property is not my responsibility." My understanding is that I have a right to prune branches that might overhang my property, but is it my obligation to hire a company, scale the tree, and have it pruned? Isn't it the homeowner's responsibility to maintain this massive tree and have it properly pruned so as to not to endanger the well-being and property of a neighbor? Signed, Arboring, a grudge. Dear Arboring, a grudge. It sounds like your neighbor is not acting very neighborly. She is lucky that the limb only harmed the fence and not a person or animal. While she might be correct that it is not her technical responsibility, it should be her moral responsibility to help you with your fence, especially because it was her tree that caused the damage. Sadly, if the tree is 100% on your neighbor's lawn, it is her right to do with the tree what she wants. The only thing you have the right to do is trim the leaves that hang onto your property. And finally, from the community briefs, American Legion Post 210 will serve spaghetti from 5 to 7 p.m. today, with Captain's 3 Band performing from 6 to 8 p.m. Wednesday's drawing features pork roast, 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday offers chicken and noodle dinner from 5 to 7 p.m. and trivia night with Rick Almanson from 7 to 9. Friday's menu includes fish, hamburgers, chicken, and tenderloins from 5 to 7:30 p.m. Saturday has all-you-can-eat chicken and fish from 6 to 7:30. Governor Davis will be in concert 8 to 11 p.m. Saturday with a $5 ticket. Breakfast will be served from 8:30 to 11 a.m. on Sunday, and all are welcome. And that takes us to the end of our time for today. This has been the Vermilion County News for Tuesday, October 15th, 2019. My name's Greg, and it's been a pleasure to read for you. I hope you have a wonderful day. Take care.